Over the decades, I've donated two of my daughters to the Australian diaspora, so I find the story particularly interesting. When someone leaves their country of origin to work or live for an extended period overseas, it's called outward migration. Collectively, they're known as the diaspora. Pretty much every country has one. It's a loose group, sometimes centred on particular countries, sometimes spread throughout the world. Now, the reasons for leaving varies, as do their skills and length of time away. And while the diaspora are acknowledged as an extremely valuable resource, successive governments haven't yet developed a policy to guide and harness this, this all-but-forgotten asset. Now, to explain why this might be, we're joined by Andrew Rosser. Andrew is Professor of Southeast Asian Studies at the University of Melbourne. Andrew, welcome.
Hi, Philip. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Who are the Australian diaspora? I understand there's more than a million of them.
Look, that's right. The number that gets bandied about when people are talking about the size of the Australian diaspora at present is 1 million. That is a very, very loose estimate of the size of the Australian diaspora. I mean, one of the key features of the discussion about an Australian diaspora and specifically an Australian diaspora policy is that we don't have terribly good data on the Australian diaspora.
So it's a guesstimate rather than an accurate figure.
I think guesstimate is probably an appropriate term to use. As I understand it, the figure was initially produced by DFAT in its submission to a Senate inquiry into Australian expatriates. It was held in the early 2000s. At the time, DFAT estimated that Australia had a diaspora, that is a group of Australians living abroad on a long-term or permanent basis, of around about 850,000 and another 250,000 living abroad on a short-term basis. People have taken that figure of 850,000, projected forward to the current day, and guessed that the current figure should be around about a million people. But the methodology used to produce that figure back in the early 2000s and the definition of diaspora used are unclear.
Now, mostly they were living in the UK, the US and New Zealand, but you will be telling us about the growing proportion who live in Asia.
Look, that's right. Increasingly, the Australian diaspora is to be found in Asia, and in particular in countries such as Singapore, Hong Kong, China, but also the countries of Southeast Asia. So there has been a shift taking place over time in favour of Asian destinations.
And surely they can use their local knowledge, their networks, to, promote bilateral trade, for example.
Well, look, those people who argue in favour of a diaspora policy make precisely that point. Essentially, they argue that the Australian diaspora is not a lost resource for Australia. The fact that these Australians are living overseas doesn't mean they're of no use to Australia at all. In fact, quite the contrary. To the extent that they have market knowledge, technical expertise, networks, and so on that are useful to Australia, they're a resource that can be harnessed to help promote economic and social development back in Australia.
Andrew, you used the term the collaboration deficit. Please explain.
Right. Well, that's a term used actually in one of the reports that's been produced in recent times on the Australian diaspora. I think it's attributable to PricewaterhouseCoopers. In fact, I think it's a term that they use, if I'm remembering things correctly. And it basically is a term that relates to collaboration, international collaboration between with industry. And the idea is that members of the Australian diaspora return home after having a period abroad where they've developed new networks, new expertise, and so on, they can bring that expertise back home and help Australian businesses collaborate internationally to the mutual benefit of those businesses and their international partners.
Over the years, we've often talked about other diasporas on the program, Andrew, and very often they're pretty poor people, and they're sending back remittance payments to family. That's not the case with our diaspora, of course.
The Australian diaspora does send back some level of remittances, but it's tiny as a proportion of Australian GDP. The Filipino diaspora is one that is well known for sending remittances back home, and the remittances it sends back home account for something like 9 or 10% of GDP. They're a really, really key source of growth, and that simply isn't the case with the Australian diaspora. So, you know, to the extent that proponents of a diaspora policy see some economic value in the fact Australia has a diaspora, it lies not in their ability to produce remittances for Australia, but more in their ability to facilitate trade and investment and knowledge-based linkages.
They're sometimes referred to as gold-collar workers.
Well, a certain segment of the diaspora is often described in that way. Back in the early 2000s, Michael Fullilove at the Lowy Institute and Chloe Flutter wrote a very useful report on the Australian diaspora, where they distinguish between a number of different elements within the Australian diaspora. Gold collar workers was one of those elements. The term refers to people who work in professional jobs and in very, very senior roles in their profession. So they're people who are at the top of their game professionally. But Fullilove and Flutter also identified some other elements within the diaspora at the top of the hierarchy, if you like, or a group they called the Who's Who. These are, you know, the Matthias Cormans and the Hugh Jackmans and so on. I mean, they're the people who hold very, very prominent sorts of positions or play very, very prominent roles in the industries of which they're a part. The other main groups they identified are just regular professionals, return migrants, and what they called rite of passage migrants. Typically young people who go abroad for a sort of, first experience, extended experience abroad to see the world, and they mix work with holidaying.
I'm talking to Andrew Rosser, who's now going to take us back to 2003 and tell us about the late Graham Hugo.
Well, Graham was, prior to his death a few years ago, one of Australia's leading migration experts. And he's particularly important in the context of this conversation because he was the lead author of a major report published in 2003 for the Australian Government and the Committee for the Economic Development of Australia, or CEDA. That report was on the Australian diaspora, and it remains to this day the most substantial piece of analysis that's been done on both the nature of the Australian diaspora and the policy issues surrounding it.
Okay, Andrew, let's explore some of the reasons why there is a need for an Australian diaspora policy. You note the diaspora are particularly useful when it comes to developing business and cultural ties with Asia. The need for a policy, please.
Well, look, proponents of a diaspora policy typically make a number of points in favour of the adoption of a policy. The first is that Australia has a sizeable diaspora. It's not particularly large in comparative terms, but it's not small either, at 1 million people or so. It's said to be a particularly talented diaspora. It's relatively well educated. It's relatively well regarded by employers. A second point that gets made is, as we've discussed, the diaspora is a repository of market knowledge and networks and so on that can help facilitate economic and social development back in Australia and stimulate innovation at home as well on the part of Australian businesses. Another point that gets made is that diaspora policies are becoming increasingly common, or if not diaspora policies, and other sorts of strategic interventions by states to reach out to their diasporas to sort of harness the potential they present in terms of homeland development. And a final point, and this is one that's been made particularly recently, and especially on the part of the Australian business community organisations like the BCA, for instance. The argument is that, on the other side of COVID-19, Australia is going to be looking for new sources of growth. Asia beckons. Asia has come out of the, or is coming out of COVID-19 relatively well placed. It's going to remain, as it has been for a number of decades, a key source of economic growth and development within the world. And if Australia is going to grow its economy in the future, it needs to be plugged into that. And the diaspora is seen as being a way in which Australia can do that.
Now, Australia's relationship with China has become, well, to use a diplomatic term, more complex in recent times. A diaspora policy may well help us overcome some of those hiccups.
Our hiccups with China, I mean, perhaps there's certainly an argument made that Australia's diaspora can be an instrument of public diplomacy, that it can act as an advocate on behalf of the Australian nation in its relationships with other countries, and that would arguably apply to China as much as any other country.
Once these highly skilled people who left Australia were thought of as part of a brain drain, but you think it's time to change that view?
I think it's fair to say that there is a consensus now that Australia is not experiencing a brain drain. The Australian diaspora is largely the product of outward migration since the mid to late 1990s, mid to late 1980s, sorry. And through the 80s and 90s and into the early 2000s, there was some concern within Australia that the country was experiencing a brain drain. And in fact, it was that concern that led to the Senate inquiry on Australian expatriates in the early 2000s, but the conclusion of that inquiry, and I think it reflects the consensus that I've just referred to, was that because Australia operates a skilled immigration program, it in fact experiences a net brain gain. At the same time, having a diaspora, particularly one with the characteristics that we've discussed, does open up the opportunity for Australia to take advantage of the networks, the expertise and so on that the diaspora has.
You make the point that it's not accurate to say the Australian government has done nothing, because it has done some things in this space.
That's right. I mean, Australia lacks an overarching strategic policy document to guide its relationship with the Australian diaspora, but that's not to say it doesn't have specific policies that relate to the diaspora. Australia decided almost 20 years ago now, for instance, to permit expatriate dual citizenship. So Australians who went abroad and in the past had lost their citizenship because they took out the citizenships of other countries, were allowed to, or at least after the passage of amendments to the Citizenship Act, were in similar cases were allowed to have dual citizenship. The Australian government also allows Australian expatriates to vote in Australian elections under certain sort of restrictive conditions, but that are a bit of an issue. But, you know, there are policies like that in place. And of course, you know, as we're all well aware at the moment, the Australian government, as part of its response to COVID-19, effectively delayed the return of many Australians living overseas. So, you know, it's another example of a policy that applies to the diaspora. I mean, what's missing is some sort of broad, overarching strategy to guide
that relationship. Well, Andrew, thank you for alerting us to this and for contributing to our little program. The voice of Andrew Rosser, Professor of Southeast Asian Studies at the University of Melbourne.